From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Playwright Edward Albee brought the heat when he came to Broadway in 1962 with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The biting, lacerating drama of a marriage in meltdown, slashing, scalding, drunk, and getting drunker. It was shocking in 1962, and now, 50 years later, and on Broadway again, it's still shocking. This hour, On Point, Brutal Love and Hate, and Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf all over again. You can join the conversation. Is this just what marriage is? Some part of it at the heart of some? Love and hate all bound together? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll go to Pam McKinnon, big director of Albee Plays, who has brought Virginia Woolf back to Broadway. But first, with us from New York is Charles Isherwood, top drama critic for the New York Times. He's a big fan of the new production. Superlative, exhilarating, fresh, scalding. Charles Isherwood, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
What makes this still live? You love the production. What is it about the drama itself that still has legs 50 years later?
Well, all those adjectives you mentioned, blistering, lacerating, and those kind of things are certainly still there. But what I think was so striking about this production is how moving it was, how emotionally engrossing it was. I've seen other productions where you're sort of dazzled by the verbal wordplay and the, you know, very big performances that actors can bring to it. But here I really felt from the very opening moments that there was – at the, you know, the bottom of their relationship, the relationship between George and Martha, a profound sense of love, that they really did have this great dependency that was buried underneath sort of growing years of annoyance and acrimony.
I mean, many people will think of Taylor and Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton in the movie, of course. Many will have seen it on Broadway way back. But compared to what we saw in Taylor and Burton, how is the love shown in this new Broadway version?
Well, it's a delicate thing. I mean, I think in the opening scenes, there was a wonderful emotional rapport between Tracy Letts and Amy Morton, possibly because they've worked together a lot before. This production originated at the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago, where I first saw it. And, you know, both of them have worked with that company a lot. I think they've played married, you know, couples before. And so they had this sort of, you know, it wasn't overt, but a very subtle indication of how, you know, how much George and Martha had grown comfortable in their lives and really do, you know, on some fundamental level, want to be with each other, even though, you know, if you watch the 3 hours of the play, you would think, why doesn't one of them run screaming to the nearest divorce lawyer?
Right, and fast. We've got some tape from the new production on Broadway. Here's a little bit from the first act, the infamous couple, George and Martha, played here, as Charles was just saying, by Tracy Letts and Amy Morton. They start up the late-night dinner party with some tough jabs as they tell their guests about their relationship.
If you happen to be teaching at a university, there are easier things than being married to the daughter of the president of that university. There are easier things in this world.
It should be an extraordinary opportunity. For some men, it would be the chance of a lifetime.
There are, believe me, easier things in this world.
Well, I can understand how it might make for some awkwardness, perhaps.
Some men would give their right arm for the chance.
Alas, Martha, in reality, it works out that the sacrifice is usually of a somewhat more private portion of the anatomy.
There you go, from the new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's got a kind of a sitcom-y, warmth, even coziness. It's repartee, but not that tough. How tough does it get in tone?
Oh, well, it gets very dark indeed. In fact, its production doesn't stint on the emotional violence at all. By the end of the evening, they're, you know, George is actually throttling Martha, and it's quite an intense moment. And, you know, in the verbal play, it gets much harsher than you certainly heard there. I think, you know, that's only one element in the play. I mean, I think by the end of the play, there were people next to me sobbing openly because they, you know, you really see how, you know, how very sad it is that these people who, you know, are both intelligent, loving people have come to this terrible pass where in order to move forward with their lives, they have to – well, George has to inflict this very sort of, you know, deep psychological wound on his wife.
Remind us just how this hit New York and Broadway back in 62, Charles. And not that you were standing on the street watching or in the theater then, but, I mean, the stories are famous of how the Pulitzer Committee said this is the one this year, but the language was just too much for the trustees to take. That didn't happen. This it really was a big – oh, my gosh, when it hit Broadway in its first opening.
Absolutely. Divided the critics. I think people sort of assume that a play that has become part of the, you know, national canon was, you know, celebrated by one and all. But in fact, a lot of critics were taken aback by it. One critic headed one of his pieces for dirty-minded females only, which I think Albee once quipped that it sold a lot of tickets. It was shocking. I think the language was not as fierce as it was today. I think Albee, you know, originally wrote it with very strong language and was, you know, made to temper it down for the Broadway premiere. But I think it's the emotional violence that was so shocking. This was before, you know, dysfunctional marriage plays and movies and television had become standard American fodder. So it was really kind of shocking to see this kind of relationship shown on what was then, you know, the commercial Broadway was, you know, it was like television or movies are today. It was a very popular art form.
Mm-hmm. And what about today? That emotional violence, you say we've become more accustomed to seeing it portrayed. Does that mean there's less power in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Or is there something elemental that still has that great power?
Well, I think he wrote of it with such insight and such great humor that this play is never going to be, I think, surpassed in its portrait of a bad marriage. It's certainly one of the classic ones. There are others, too. Ingmar Bergman, you know, did his part. But I think it really remains. You know, the important thing is when a great play, you know, no matter what its subject matter, has to be illuminating some truths about the human condition, but in an aesthetic form that is really satisfying. If you have one and not the other, it's not going to work. This one has both, and that's why I think it's really an enduring work of American art.
Charles Isherwood is a drama critic for the New York Times. He and others with rave reviews for the new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Edward Albee's play, now back on Broadway at 50. Charles, stand by. Also with us from New York right now is Pam McKinnon, Tony-nominated director, big interpreter, longtime friend of Edward Albee. She's directed his famed plays At Home at the Zoo, A Delicate Balance, The Play About the Baby, and more. And now she's brought Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf back to Broadway. It opened last Saturday. Terrific reviews. Pam McKinnon, congratulations and welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be here.
What is at the heart of the insight that Albee brings us here about men and women or relationships and love?
I go to the theater because I like to laugh, and I also like to feel badly about characters. And I think Edward has tied those two things together in this piece. He has two couples. We've talked a bit about George and Martha, mm-hmm. but I also think Nick and Honey are just fascinating. And there's something, in some respects, I think that Nick and Honey's marriage is much more dysfunctional than George and Martha's.
This is the younger couple that gets drawn into the sort of brawl of older George and Martha and expose themselves in many dimensions before it's over.
Absolutely. And there's a chilling lack of empathy between them and lack of respect. And there's something that I think that couple, because this is a real quartet, they sort of infect George and Martha. And sort of over the course of the evening, things come to light in the relationship between George and Martha because Nick and Honey are there. I mean, there's something. There are two forms of dysfunctional marriage on that stage.
How universal is the message in this from Edward Albee, that you've got love and hate at the somewhere down in the grain of every marriage, or love and hate in the grain of a bad marriage?
I think if you're in the long term with another person and you're marching through life two by two, there are going to be disappointments that arise. There are going to be, strong feelings that run the gambit. I think there is truth in that.
And did you set out to show us something different in this play today in 2012 from straight ahead performance in 1962? Did you think, well, what's the aspect, the angle that we need to bring forward here, new?
No, it wasn't so much going in with a mission other than, I'm happy that people are really seeing this, so I think sort of mission accomplished, mm-hmm. but other than really making sure that the love between George and Martha is palpable, and also honoring Edward's three act structure, the titles of his three acts. The first act is Fun and Games, and I really took that to heart. I have seen productions of this play where I feel like there is sort of a a narrower tone, and that first act, you do get a feeling of, like, why aren't Nick and Honey running for the hills? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was really, and that, we talked about that a lot in rehearsal, that, you know, can this be lighter? Can this be lighter? The clip that we heard earlier is one of the few subjects that Martha really doesn't like George to bring up, the topic of belittling her father in the first act, you know, so much so that she storms out of the room and then comes in. She changes her clothes. She actually uses it as an opportunity. But, you know, other than that, they're just sparring. They can roll with each other.
Pam McKinnon, director of the big new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Edward Albee's great play on Broadway right now in New York, and Charles Isherwood, drama critic for The New York Times. It's great to have both of you with us. A little theme from the 1966 film version behind us here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Edward Albee's great play, back on Broadway, getting great reviews 50 years on, still lighting up the crazy dark corners of marriage. The director of the new production, Pam McKinnon, joins us today from New York. Tony, nominated theater director. She's done a lot of Albee and much more. Death of a Salesman, Bruce Norris's Cliburn Park, and much, much more. Terrific director, getting just rave reviews for what she's putting on right now on Broadway. Opened last weekend. Among those saying, yes, indeed, Charles Isherwood, drama critic for the New York Times. He's with us today as well. You can find a link to his review at our website, onpointradio.org. Came out in 1962. 1966, Mike Nichols directed the film version with Elizabeth Taylor as Martha, revealing her shame here that her husband, Richard Burton's character George, who has a whiskey bottle about to be smashed in his hand, never had the ambition to take over for her father as president of the university.
Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while, until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, that maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff. That maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary. Not on an associate professor's salary.
There's the Taylor-Burton version, and here just a bit from the new production on Broadway with Amy Morton as Martha and, of course, Tracy Lett as George. Here we go.
George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was a sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
I said stop, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George.
Amy Morton, Tracy Letts in the new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Charles Isherwood, give us a little bit of your critic's ear on those two renditions of this passage from the play right there.
Well, it's interesting to hear Elizabeth Taylor in quite that a deeply acerbic mode. You certainly don't associate that with her, except that, of course, she won an Academy Award.
Yes.
I mean, in a way that you know, that snatch you hear there sounds more intense, you know, on film because theater is a different proposition, of course. What I think is so great about the performances of both Amy Morton and Tracy Letts is how modulated they are so that you're not always at that intense, shrill pitch that, you know, you certainly heard Elizabeth Taylor reaching. And I think they really find all sorts of dynamics in these roles that make them really quite, in a way, for me, more complex than they've ever been before.
Pam, what's the interplay here in your mind, in the actor's mind, if it's there at all, of original, of film, of renditions you may have seen in years since? How do all these weave together, you know, when you're sitting there in the director's chair thinking about producing what you want here?
I mean, you know, I think it, for me and these actors also, these are, you know, delicious stage animal actors.
Yes, yes.
It really starts with the text and you know the opening line. There is laughter. Martha comes in and she's admonishing George, saying Jesus. He says shh. H Christ,
mm-hmm.
And we start there. So it's given circumstance. It's words on the page. Edward also has sort of these great, I call them parenthetical emotional stage directions, which can drive actors crazy, but at times are a great roadmap for me. It will say stuff like wounded in parentheses, or about to laugh, or barely containing himself. And actors, you know, for a while go a little bit nuts because it can be so prescriptive, but as a director, it gives me a roadmap, and it wasn't about deciding to sign on to the movie or other productions that I've seen. I mean, it's a great constellation of actors and this play, and I reacted to what they could bring to the table.
So when you hear that hyper-compressed kind of rage in Elizabeth Taylor's cinematic voice there, and then Amy's more open, maybe here's a little bit where you're letting the love shine a little more. Is that a distinction you were looking for, or just what you naturally found in your reading, her reading of this play?
Yeah, I think it's where we landed as a team, as a group, and that is at the end of the first act. I think a someone smashing a bottle in a living room is indicative of a, you know, huge undercurrent of anger. It's a hugely violent, shocking act in and of itself. And the fact that Martha's language pushes George to that place at the end of Act One is, in my mind, just sort of shocking enough. So yes, I think you know it is more modulated. It's also so fun. You know, we heard the audience laughing, and
yeah.
I want that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they laugh until they, as Charles Isherwood said, cry.
Absolutely.
It's over. Let's bring our listeners in. Beaufort, North Carolina, Michael's calling. Michael, you're on with director Pam McKinnon and Charles Isherwood of the New York Times.
Hi. I'm sorry if I would love to see the play. And someone mentioned use the word quartet for this. And, you know, it occurred to me that this is almost like a classical quartet where you can have many people play it and comment on the differences. But I must say that having seen the movie, it'll be hard for me. I just want to bring up that it seemed to me the four actors in the movie were so perfectly kind of seemed to be cast. And the whole drama of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton off the screen at that time was so known to everyone who was living through those years that the impact and the movie was just so well done. It was unforgettable. And I understand there may be different ways of doing it, so but I just want to say that it'll be hard for someone who saw the movie to get that vision out with any kind of different kind of playing of the quartet.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll take it to both of our guests, Michael, and thanks for your call. Charles Isherwood, what about as a critic? You see many versions of many productions, you know, most on stage in your case. But how do you move from one to the next and, I don't know, clean the palette or play one against another?
Well, it's certainly true that is as I was saying to Pam before, I think the movie version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is one of the rare instances where a great play has been made into a great movie. I certainly wouldn't argue that those are four intensely wonderful performances. You know, it's just, once again, it's you get four great actors together and magic occurs. But for me, you know, I think that movie sort of influenced the casting of the play over the years in the sense that Elizabeth Taylor played it so big that it became the star role. And so you would very often see, you know, female stars who in some ways dominated, mm-hmm. you know, their male counterparts. What I think is so revelatory about this production is that Tracy Letts gives such a phenomenal performance, not to take anything away from Amy Morton because it's very much a collaboration,
yeah.
but we really see the dynamics of the play very differently. It's not about, you know, Martha ceaselessly goading him forever into just this one, you know, he finally fights back. Throughout the play, he is the one who's really in control. He's the one who sees the psychology behind what's going on. And I have to say, at times I feel like You know, Broadway is very star-centric now, and which is sometimes unfortunate because stars, you know, bring with them the personalities that they've established, you know, in the public sphere. And I think in this case, by not casting it with, you know, name stars, it's really allowing audiences to see the play itself in a more clarified form. At least for me, I think that's a very important point to make. I think people will see it differently.
Pam, important to the film, obviously, that offstage relationship that our caller Michael mentions. Everybody knew about that at the time. Here you've got a different take on it, where you have two actors, I mean, four, quartet, obviously, but the George and Martha, Tracy and Amy, who, look, they're not married, and they haven't, I suppose, fought in Vegas, or maybe they have, but they've certainly been on stage a lot, and everybody comments on how that shows up in the kind of chemistry that they bring to Broadway now.
Yeah, they from the get-go have a great shorthand with each other, really trust each other. I think they've played married couples. Maybe this is their seventh time. They've been on stage together over a span of 22 years. You know, and George and Martha are married for 23. So that's pretty close. You know, so a lot of that kind of inventing and intimacy, we didn't have to invent it. It was already there. You know, the fact that they just implicitly trust each other was amazing, and it meant that our rehearsal process could sort of start where a lot of rehearsals end.
We've got Seth writing to us here. Says, saw it last week. Fantastic production. So there's another thumbs up for you here. A.B. Wright says, can the guest please explain the title of the play? Maybe I'm just dumb, but I never totally understood the connection with Virginia Woolf. Pam?
Well, Edward says that he this was I think he was still in his 20s at the time, and it was graffiti sprawled in soap on a mirror in a West Village, I guess, bar, and he was amused by it, and it, you know, he clearly saved it up, and about 8 years later wrote this play, and it's you know, I think Virginia Woolf is thought of as someone who mines the depths of the subconscious and you know, talks about sort of existential issues, and a lot of at the core of Martha is fear, and fear of how to move through an authentic life. Putting Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf to the tune of Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf.
That resonates from the old Three Little Pigs song and all the rest.
Exactly.
Disney cartoon, yeah.
Exactly. So we hear this song four times. The first time as a bit of a lark to help cheer up George. It's something that was sung at the cocktail party prior to the play that we're seeing. The second time, George uses it to deflect sort of shame from himself, and then we also hear it at the end of the play as George tries to comfort Martha. And so this notion of fear, this notion of know thyself, you know, and ultimately this little bit of sort of flippant rhetoric is answered at the end of the play by Martha, and she answers the question, I am George, I am.
Who's afraid? Listener A.B., think Big Bad Wolf and all that represents in terms of human fears, and you go some way toward understanding that title. Let's take a call from Montpelier, Vermont, and Dan. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because back in the 80s, I lived with a man named William Stringfellow, who was a fairly noted theologian who had lived for many, many years with Anthony Towne, who was a poet. And Bill Stringfellow always claimed to me that Anthony Towne had been at the dinner party that Edward Albee based the play on, and that the dinner party was of two gay couples. And I've never had the chance to contact Mr. Albee yet. I plan to, I hope to, but I still haven't. I'm sort of the keeper of Anthony Towne's papers, and I've always been curious to know whether there was such a original germ of a dinner party, and the fact or the idea that it being a party of two gay couples, just seems like an interesting frame for it, especially with what's happening.
Absolutely. Dan, I'll put that question. What about the themes in this play? Do they still work for you, Dan?
They would for me. Absolutely.
That sounds like the would for me of someone who knows a relationship and all its complexities.
Well, I'm married to a woman, but it still would for me.
Yeah.
I know plenty of gay couples who have been together for a long time, and the issues that they struggle with are, they're pretty much the same issues that I struggle with in my marriage. And in fact, it was a gay couple that helped me take the step of marriage. It was watching them in their commitments, and even before, of course, marriage was acceptable here in Vermont. But watching gay couples work things out helped me make my own decisions to get married.
We all listen and learn from stage and otherwise. Pam, what about the origin story, the cocktail party before, behind, beneath the play?
I bet there were a lot of cocktail parties. I don't know if there was one in particular that set Edward to write this down. I mean, I love these characters, and Martha to me is very, very much a woman, and that's that's not to say that that we can't, sort of other people can't mm-hmm. empathize with her fully. I mean, I think that's one of Edward's great strengths, that he pours as much albiness into his men, into his women, into his straight characters, mm-hmm. into his gay characters, into his older characters, into his younger characters. I mean, that's why I think he's a great playwright.
Charles Isherwood, we've just got you for another minute here. What's it say that 50 years on this is back and getting such a glowing response? Does that mean it's decided here? This is a classic. That's it.
Well, I don't think there was any question at this point that it was a classic. I think it's wonderful that it's celebrating its 50th anniversary with such a great production. And I think, the play for me, what was so moving in this one is that you realize it really does speak to very universal issues about how people disappointed in their lives as individuals very often take out their antagonisms on whoever's closest to hand. And also there's the wonderful theme of, the imaginary child that they have, and they've taken refuge in this fantasy. And I think at one point he said, that there was sort of the anti-Iceman Cometh, in the sense that play argued that, it's really, you can only live life if you have your illusions intact. This play says basically you're not really facing up to life in all its, hardship, but also its beauty, if you take constant refuge in illusion. And I think that's a theme that, is very powerful, today, and will remain so throughout, as long as there are human beings, facing what we do in life.
Charles Isherwood, drama critic for the New York Times. We always love your eye on the stage, and we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, back on Broadway 50 years after its first appearance there. Edward Albee's great play, getting rave reviews 50 years on, still lighting up the dark corners of marriage. The director of the big new production, it just opened on Saturday in New York. It'll be playing through January. Pam McKinnon joins us today from New York. It's great to have her right here, and you can join us as well. Have you been in a marriage like this where you couldn't stop cutting each other? Can we ever really understand another's marriage, or do we all know what this is all about? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. In just a minute and a half here, Dr. William Doherty, Bill Doherty joins us, psychologist, marriage therapist. Let's hear a little more from Pam McKinnon's production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Here's the second act. Things going sour fast when Martha, played by Emmy Morton, brutally chides her husband George, played by Tracy Letts, over his failed novel.
You want to know what big brave Georgie
did? You will not say this!
I won't! Keep away from me, you bastard!
He caved in, is what he did. He came home and he threw the book in the fireplace and burned it.
I'll kill you!
Violence, violence, screams Honey there, and there is strangulation going on. And then in the final act, after all the fun and games are over, George bursts through the front door, attacking everyone with his words, calling Nick, played by Madison Dirks, nothing but a houseboy, Martha, played by Amy Morton, nothing but a liar. But there's something bigger at play here, truth and illusion.
Someone's lying around here. Somebody isn't playing the game straight.
Yes?
Come on, Martha. Who's lying? Come on.
Tell them I'm not a houseboy.
No, you're not a houseboy.
So be it.
Truth and illusion, George. You don't know the difference.
No, but we must carry on as though we did.
Amen.
Amen. A little laughter running through the house there on Broadway with Pat McKinnon's new production, but hard truths as well. Dr. William Bill Doherty joins us right now from St. Paul, psychologist and marriage therapist, professor, director of the Couples on the Brink Project at the University of Minnesota. He uses excerpts of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in classes on marriage counseling. He's author of Take Back Your Marriage. Bill Doherty, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
What do you use from this production that Pam now has on stage on Broadway? What do you use as a marriage counselor?
Well, I use it as a way to depict a couple with a powerful emotional bond and deep hostility, dependency, hostile dependency. And so I use it for that. And then I also use it as a way to look at how escalation can occur. Pam talked about their spar. They sparred so much and even some playful ways in the first act. But couples that spar, it can spin out of control. So I use it to show that as well.
I mean, when you see this, the play, see the movie, do you look at this and say, oh, this is drama. This is, you know, Edward Albee taking this somewhere where it doesn't really go to make a wonderful point? Or do you say, gosh, I've seen this before, you know, in my counseling room or in stories of what's going on at home in rough marriages?
Yeah, I've seen it before. So that's part of why this is so fascinating. These it's so easy for people to miss the connection, the power, the attachment that these couples have. And so I'm glad – I haven't seen the new production yet, but I'm glad that that's coming out more, because that's part of grasping what's powerful about the human condition in this, is how bonded they are. How much love there is in some ways, and yet how much of this anger and fury comes out. And you know, it reminds me, I'm thinking of a couple I saw some years ago, very, very much at our sparring all the time, some big blow-ups. And occasionally they'd have great sex, and they'd say to each other after that, "This, by the way, this doesn't mean I like you."
that was just a timeout, and back we go to the pugilism.
They would tell me this with some smile and some laughter.
Sheesh. Pam, you know Edward Albee well. He named the main characters here George and Martha. I mean, does this go back to, I mean, our original George and Martha, Washington and, you know, George Washington and wife Martha? Is he trying to make this the American marriage somehow?
I think so. I think that's part of his project. I think sort of, you know, very much like, let's take another great, great work of literature like Lolita. You can footnote this play in a delightful, delightful way. But yet it's also an incredibly active, funny, visceral piece of theater. So, George and Martha is no accident.
And what about there's a sub-theme or maybe more than that running through this, where the young Nick who's there is the scientist on the rise, and you've got George as your historian and humanist. We've got a listener reminding us today, you know, that world on the sly, the sciences on the rise. Listener writes in to say, this is a great American drama about potency and impotency, humanism and science. Do you feel it, Pam?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it takes place, very late at night. We start at 2 a.m. on a small liberal arts campus. And this is a passionate issue for George. His world is being encroached. There's this hotshot biologist that he's gotten wind of, and he is now on campus, and money is going that way. And George is not happy about it.
And so history turns and marriages too. Let's go to Josh in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm also a marriage counselor here in Stillwater. And I think this is a great depiction or art depicting life, because I see a lot of couples and they just feel stuck. They feel stuck in the conflict and they don't know how to get out, but they know they want to fight for the relationship, but they just don't know how to do it. They have no clue how to make their relationship better. You know, I think this is a great depiction for marriages to take a look at, you know, and I think a lot of couples see themselves in this and wonder, yeah, I'm going through that too. How can I make this better? Because I just feel hopeless.
Yeah, whether it's St. Paul in Minneapolis or in Stillwater, Oklahoma, what about the stuck quality here, Bill Doherty, Dr. Doherty? Many couples must recognize that, but yet this much, this kind of, you know, epical rage and readiness to cut?
Well, and not not a lot of couples have this degree of rage, but the stuck a lot of people can identify with. The playing the same games. I, you know, tell some couples they could just send dueling audio recordings because they have the same fights all the time. This couple has them in a more clever way. But, you know, for a lot of people, they think, well, why don't they just divorce? This is a couple who emotionally, even if they do divorce, they have what I call an unconsummated divorce. If they don't deal with the issues that are facing them, they will go on until death do them part fighting. Many couples have children. Of course, these have an imaginary child.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points I want to make is the triangles that occur here. A couple that has this degree of conflict almost always is in a triangle with the third party. So Martha's father is a big part of their marriage.
The university president, the big icon
of
success.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so some of the bitterest conflicts are around that triangle. For couples who have children, unfortunately, and this is where these relationships get so destructive for the next generation, they triangle their children. They get their children to take sides. In the play, Honey and Nick are triangled, to use our buzzwords in the mm-hmm. field. They're triangled into this conflict.
And also triangled in an imaginary child. I mean, this inability to conceive becomes a very potent part, or the opposite, of the strain between George and Martha.
Yeah, they both feel this tremendous lack of fertility, if you will, for George with his career, his book, and for her not giving birth. And these are the wounds. This is the grief. There's usually tremendous unresolved grief. Martha's mother died when she was a young child, and then she had an acting out adolescence, and then she tried to be conventional. But there's all this unresolved grief that's feeding the fury.
Conception issues as big an issue today as 50 years ago with all the advances in fertility medicine and the rest, Bill?
Oh, the feelings are the same. Absolutely. And in fact, the disappointments are as great or perhaps greater when you go through all of the infertility treatment and the years and the monitoring and the artificial times when you have to have sex and then it doesn't mm-hmm. work. So it's very, very painful.
Josh in Oklahoma, thanks for your call. David in Arlington, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Well.
You know, not everything has to come back around to politics. Maybe it's good to escape from it sometime. But I remember hearing an interview with Albee where he said what shocked me, which is that this, you mentioned George and Martha Washington, that this started off as a political allegory for him. And that there was, that it was, that this was very, the beginning of the play. And it does strike me that there's a lot of familiar in the in our own politics about this dysfunctional marriage. I'm thinking that this is what you know, the home of James Carville and Mary Maitland might be like.
Mary Maitland, so a political allegory in the sense of what, two parties who can't live together in the same national house, David, something like that.
Yeah, that we have this. Maybe I don't know if Albee saw it in the early '60s, but we have this political divide. That goes all the way back. That is just, this circular, never-ending, dead-end, unresolved argument. And we can't end it because we're all still married to one another
yeah.
in the country, as it were. It's just very interesting to me that because I always saw it, as you're discussing it today, as a psychological play that about relationships, but that.
The political piece.
The political play.
Let us take it to the director. It's so great to have Pam with us. What about it, Pam? Political resonance here, or are you fully into the marriage psychology side of this?
Well, I guess in putting it up and to make it as active and emotionally visceral as possible, you know, I dove much more into the psychology. But you know, I've definitely read that Nick, he's called Nick because of Khrushchev. I mean, we're talking, you know, 1961 when it was written, 1962 when it premiered.
Nikita Khrushchev.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're marching through the Cuban Missile Crisis. There are phrases here and there, like George at one point uses the phrase, "If we all survive." I mean, so sort of the direness of the Cold War and you know, fingers hovering above buttons, I think also informs this evening. There is sort of an 11th hour attempt to either broach a gap, you know, broach a divide, or we will self-destruct. And I think that is political. I think it is larger than merely two marriages.
Politics always come in. We're looking at Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf 50 years after its first production, with the director of the new Broadway production, Pam McKinnon, on last weekend into January. Patrick in Buffalo, New York. Patrick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quick question. Edward Albee is known to insist upon seeing all the headshots and resumes of all the actors that are cast in his productions, which is far more influence than most playwrights have on their scripts once they've been published and they're being produced widely all over.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that condition of his had any effect on this production. And the follow-up question is there indication of why this is? Is he trying to prevent fat actors from playing his roles? Is he trying to prevent minority actors from playing his roles? Is he trying to prevent actors that are the wrong age from playing his roles? I'll take my answer off the air, but I'm just curious to know if anyone has any information about that piece of the puzzle.
Well, it's a great question. Of course, Pam, you would know very well. You've worked with him plenty. And yes, he takes a very sort of on-scene interest in his plays. What about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, he is alive and well. He's a living playwright. He should be involved. I work with a number of writers who take that kind of interest, even if they aren't in the rehearsal hall every day. It might be a little uncommon. This is a 50-year-old play. I mean, how interested can he still be? But he recognizes that his name will always be attached to his play, and he is very interested. I bet he's seen some dreadful productions where had it been cast differently, it would have gone better. So he is very interested. You know, and a headshot resume. You know, yes, you see what this actor looks like on one side, but you flip it over and you see, you know, a list of roles. Mm-hmm. And you can tell if someone is cast as Romeo, that means something versus someone who has been cast as, I don't know, as Tybalt, let's say, in Romeo and Juliet.
Does like he have, you know, intervention power? Can he say,
sure.
he does?
Sure.
He can
he,
say
he has the right of refusing people
on casting. What about directing? He said, no, Pam, please don't do it that way. Do it this way. Can he do that? Does he have?
Well, he came out to Chicago and came to some rehearsals. And I work a lot with playwrights, and I love that exchange. Mm-hmm. And he definitely attended rehearsal. He gave me some notes, and they were nothing but helpful. I mean, he loves actors. He loves, you know, he recognizes he's not about putting people into some cookie cutter mold. I mean, his plays can be done in many different ways and by a wide array of people. When we were actually out in Chicago, I met my Nick and Honey through auditions. They're not Steppenwolf Company members. They're wonderful Chicago actors. And we cast the net really widely, and I did see people I saw actresses of color for the role of Honey. I mean, mm-hmm. that was sure. You know, that was definitely I was looking for the best actor who could really bring this role to life.
Well, I think you've done well, Bill Doherty. We've just got a minute here. This love hate ratio in a relationship, let's say in a marriage relationship. I mean, you're a marriage counselor. Now, how widely does it vary? Is there love and hate in every marriage that you see? You know, do you have half and half versus 90-10 or 80-20?
Well, it depends how you define hate. There's love. I mean, nobody gets married without some feelings of love. And the ratio of positive to negative feelings, let me just put it that way, tends to be really very skewed towards the positive when people get together. Otherwise, they wouldn't get married. But then both the daily, everyday life tends to erode some of the positives just with the small nitpicky things. But then their enduring vulnerabilities start to come out. Marriage is like a furnace, and everybody melts down at some level of heat, okay?
Yeah.
And so that starts to come out over time.
And the heat will come. It's the nature of life. Edward Albee caught it 50 years ago. It's back on stage now. Dr. William Bill Doherty, author of Take Back Your Marriage, Sticking Together in a World that Pulls Us Apart, joining us today from St. Paul. It's so good to have you. Thank you very much, Bill, for being here.
My pleasure.
And Pam McKinnon, director of the big new production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, opened last Saturday, running into January on Broadway. Pam, congratulations.
Tom, may I say we have now extended through the end of February.
Hey, the reviews are
exciting.
They're good. It's
exactly.
Exciting. Congratulations big time on that, Pam. Thank you so much for being with us today. Pam McKinnon, listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.